Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to Sparks. This week, the BBC make awful noises on FM. And I don't mean Radio 1. Fascinating facts about envelopes, a bit of chaos theory, obscene computer discs, flaky recording tapes, and how to preserve them longer. Also, two interviews, one with Bruce Gyngell from TVAM, the other from Liz Howell, who is the programme director of Sunrise TV, which is to take over the morning TV franchise. That's all this week on Sparks from Radiofax on 3910, 6205 and 12255 every Monday and Tuesday. Tommy Murphy, who sends us a postcard from the Mississippi, which is where he's holidaying at the moment. He sends best regards to all at Radiofax. And hello to Carlo Prazzoli, who's in Agazio in Italy. He listens on 3910, and thanks for your descriptions of the programmes. You'll be getting your station card, etc. And in Derby, Sinfin Moor is the place. It's Terry Leverett writing, I'm 47 years old and self-employed as a pyrography artist, which is turning pictures and designs on various wooden articles. Some people have very strange things to do with soldering irons, don't they? I prefer circuit boards myself, but what he does is much more artistic, I'm sure. He's got very nice handwriting. I listen to shortwave broadcasts for around 6 to 7 hours a day. And about 3 weeks ago, whilst tuning around, I came upon one of your broadcasts on 3910. And although at that time the reception was very poor and suffered interference from other channels, I continued to listen and have since picked you up on 6205 and once on 12255. The best reception on average seems to be 6205 in daylight and 3910 after dark, where I live on the southern outskirts of Derby. On two occasions now, I've also caught snatches of what appeared to be technical broadcasts about radio and TV, and would like to hear more, as well as your music from yesteryear programmes. With this in mind, would you please send me a programme schedule if you have one, and if possible, some details about yourselves, as I can find nothing in the World Radio TV Handbook. Well, that's a disappointment to us too. I'm very much a novice shortwave listener of around 12 months and have progressed from a grotty 1495 portable radio with shortwave to a Sony 2001D with an AN1 active antenna, which is a great improvement. Keep up the good work and I look forward to hearing from you. That's from Terry Leverett. Thanks for your letter. Well, the programme schedule roughly, I just mentioned Tommy Murphy, who's on Wednesdays and Thursdays with World of Country, alternating every fortnight with Radio Caroline, we hope. And after that, on Fridays and Saturdays, it's Jodie's Rock Show, or alternatively, Unhinged People, or else Martin D, who doesn't seem to be completely unhinged. And on Sunday, it's Paul Bentley with his Gold Year featured every week. And of course, Monday and Tuesday, it's Sparks.
While down in the West Country recently, I was driving along and spotted a pump-up telescopic mast emerging from the corner of a field. On investigating, at the top of the mast, there was a vertical collinear aerial array. At the bottom of the mast was a BBC Land Rover, unattended at the time. Selecting the rather inadequate VHF signal in the area on the car radio, I then pressed automatic search.
The World at One. This is Nick Clark with 40 minutes of news and comment.
After quite a short interval, the car radio produced this noise on 91.1. So, a loud buzzing noise, all of 75 kHz deviation on 91.1 being transmitted by the BBC. No identification, but presumably they have a license for this kind of thing. And it was an experimental field strength survey for a new service for the town of Chard. The transmitter they were using was in a field at a place called Lidmarsh. That's going east from the town of Chard on the road towards Cricket St Thomas. It was on a hillside, and it also provides coverage apart from the town of Chard. It was a reasonable signal down the Axe Valley to Axminster. Further down the valley to the coast, there was some kind of service also to Colliton, Axmouth, Colliford and Seaton. The signal is also detectable in Lyme Regis, but of course down in that steep valley it doesn't help provide any kind of coverage for the national networks. So, if you hear this peculiar noise on the FM band, you might just have stumbled across test transmissions from a BBC Land Rover and a pump-up mast in preparation for choosing a site for a new relay station for your area. So that was 91.1, just 3 kilometres east of Chard.
That's the BBC making awful noises on FM. And who says we always poke fun at the independent sector? FM problems in Public Address magazine. Some 15 years ago, the Home Office allocated a frequency in the emergency service part of the band, as was Band 2, which is where the police used to be, very intelligently, which was exactly 10.7 MHz above the frequency of a local Radio 3 transmitter. A receiver tuned to the Radio 3 broadcast had its local oscillator also 10.7 MHz above the Radio 3 frequency. AM radio receivers do not normally suffer interference from a transmitter spaced by the IF intermediate frequency from the tuned frequency, unless the interference is very strong. However, with simple FM receivers using a bipolar transistor as a mixer oscillator, quite a weak interfering signal at oscillator frequency can phase modulate the local oscillator. As far as the rest of the receiver is concerned, this phase modulation becomes part of the program being received and can't be filtered out in the IF amplifier. The interfering transmitter was soon moved to another frequency, and the frequency planners agreed not to make allocations liable to cause this problem in future. Unfortunately, such promises are sometimes not passed on to new planners. Consequently, the problem came up again a few years ago in another part of the country, and was again resolved by changing one of the transmitter frequencies. However, the pressure on channel space is now so great that the frequency planners want to be able to space transmitters serving the same area, not 10.7 MHz apart, but 10.6 or 10.8 MHz. Unfortunately, many receivers now use ceramic filters instead of ALC circuits in the IF amplifier, and these are batched with different center frequencies, e.g. 10.6 MHz and 10.8 MHz, to increase yield in mass production. This clearly increases the likelihood of interference occurring, and at first sight it may be puzzling that two apparently identical receivers, one with 10.8 MHz IF, suffers from interference, whilst the other, with a 10.6 or 10.7 MHz IF, does not. This is a problem which cannot be peculiar to the UK. Experts in other countries are therefore being consulted to see if there is any solution in planning terms. The solution at the receiver end is not to use a bipolar mixer oscillator. FET mixer oscillators and bipolar mixers with separate oscillator are much less prone to suffer this form of interference. Meanwhile, if you receive a complaint about interference on FM, this may be the cause of the trouble, and once you know the cause, the cure should be obvious. For anyone who's doing any FM transmitting, that is. And that's from the Public Address magazine, which is the official journal of the Sound and Communications Industries Federation.
In one of the most crass pieces of frequency management, Britain, uniquely in the world, continued to install more and more police transmitters after the international FM bans had been allocated. Many criminals listen to the police on ordinary portable radios, and now the police have finally been moved away, the criminals have followed. Now there are plans to scramble police transmissions. Here's a report from You and Yours.
Criminals are avoiding arrest by eavesdropping on police communications. It's illegal for anyone to listen in to police broadcasts, but lots of people do it, let's face it. After all, it's like the bill without the ads, isn't it? Obviously, though, it's no deterrent to criminals to make it illegal. So now, as Andrea Adams reports, police conversations are going to be scrambled to stay one jump ahead.
Charlie Mike, 06. Would you make number 3 Broad Street, where there is a burglary in process, received?
Charlie Mike 06 received.
Recently, officers arrived at the scene of a burglary only to hear their radio transmissions actually coming from a criminal's pocket. And when they searched him, they actually found the scanner tuned in to the police frequency.
We certainly have quite serious problems in Hampshire. There's no question about that, particularly in the larger city areas, where quite a number of people are carrying radio equipment, which allows them to listen to our broadcasts.
Do you think you're any different, any exception to other forces around the country?
No, I don't. I think we've all got a problem. For many, many years, people have been listening to police broadcasts. The difference is, over the past 10 years, radio equipment has become far more sophisticated.
Traditionally, a burglar would have had maybe a screwdriver and a torch, and now we're finding that in addition to these items, he's also got a scanner and a set of headphones as well to listen.
And what we're talking about is the high-tech crook, aren't we?
Yes. You can get scanners up to 1,000 channels these days, and you can enter all the frequencies you like. They're state-of-the-art equipment.
For Sergeant Martin and Chief Superintendent Davy of the Hampshire Force, help could be at hand in the shape of a new device developed by undergraduates at Bristol University. Their encryption unit, or scrambler, has beaten off worldwide competition to gain official approval, and in partnership with Marconi is being marketed in Britain. Professor Joe McGeehan of the University's Centre for Communication Research has led the project.
The sheer nature of the module itself means I can't say too much about it. But suffice it to say that it's rather like a gramophone record speeding up and the pitch changes. And this is done in a coded fashion. The trick, of course, is to decode it at the receiver in the correct fashion. That is extremely difficult. If somebody was to get the right code, they would hear maybe 2 seconds of the message, a word, before it changed code again. The code's changing all the time. And where are you now, Andy? Over.
I'm just heading into the office, coming round to look under the...
Well, what's happening now, this is what an authorised listener would hear, the scrambled speech. You'll notice that the time delay involved is extremely small. That's most important for people in live situations. Quite often it's extremely important to catch the first word, don't enter, as opposed to enter. And what we're really hearing now is bad news for criminals, but very good news for us. It now fits onto a very small circuit board. It's highly integrated, maybe an inch square, so it fits into existing equipment very easily and could, of course, fit into a hand-portable radio, whether it be the police or an individual using a cellular telephone on a train. For the British police, they will have a secure radio channel, and that's what they require. That's well known, as do the cellular radio people. They all require secure private communications.
Possibly the thing that will scupper the campaign to have scanners made illegal. Scrambling at an economic price. Part of a report from Radio 4's You and Yours.
Electronics design news. Book and software unravel the intricacies of the chaos theory. In James Gleick's new book, Chaos, Making a New Science, he tells a story about quantum physicist Werner Heisenberg. On his deathbed, Heisenberg declared that he would have two questions for God. Why relativity and why turbulence? He said, I really think he may have the answer to the first question. Chaos theory may not answer the second question, but it does offer a way to model the behaviour of non-linear systems, in which quantities vary over time or change from place to place in a manner that is not strictly proportional. The equations for such systems generally cannot be solved or added together. These equations model the real world instead of idealizing it by including nasty non-linear variables such as friction. In such seemingly random systems as the weather, the swinging of a pendulum, the fluctuations in wildlife populations, and even the bobbing of stock prices and the dripping of a faucet, researchers have discovered patterns. Universal laws appear to be buried in what scientists once viewed as turbulence and disorder, an impenetrable quality of the real world. Science writer Gleick worked with Autodesk to create James Gleick's Chaos, the software, a series of six interactive programs that bring to life the relationships he described in his best-selling book. Computers played a crucial role in the founding of the science of chaos. Instead of merely speeding problem-solving, scientists used computers as tools, much as biologists use microscopes and engineers use oscilloscopes, to explore graphical landscapes generated by seemingly simple equations. The programs in this package are fully realized versions of the programs that gave rise to the most important discoveries of the science of chaos. The six programs are the Mandelbrot sets, magnets and pendulums, strange attractors, the chaos game, fractal forgeries, and toy universes. Using the programs, you can tweak an image's parameters, view preset images, change colors, add sound, and move around an image by zooming, panning, and centering. Each chapter of the accompanying manual begins with Gleick's introduction to the chaos theory, the program demonstrates, and his suggestions of things to try with the program. Next are step-by-step instructions for using the program, and information about its features and options. Wrapping up each chapter is a discussion of the mathematics of that particular program. The second chapter of the manual describes the Mandelbrot set, which looks like a snowman with smaller and smaller heads attached all over it. Upon closer look, the edges of the heads look like a fine, intricate lace, whose pattern never repeats. Users can pan across the set scanning the boundary, then zoom in closer and closer, revealing layer upon layer of complexity. The actual set is a collection of points shown as black on screen. For each complex number n, the computer computes the signal of sequence of numbers n, n squared plus n, n squared plus n all squared plus n, etc. If the numbers get larger and larger, running away towards infinity, the original point is not part of the Mandelbrot set. If the point is in the set, the numbers remain locked in a repeating loop or bounce chaotically from one point to the next, but do not approach infinity. The colours of the image are like the colours of a contour map. They show how steeply the rest of the terrain falls away from the set. Points not in the set escape to infinity at varying rates, which the program shows using different colours. The geometry of the Mandelbrot set shows that processes that are simple in themselves can create complexity through repetition and feedback. The set also shows that boundaries are between, say, stability and instability in a system and not necessarily smooth. Such a boundary may be sufficiently complex that a slight change in starting conditions may throw the system off into a different region. One drawback to this software package is that it's slow. To draw an image, the program paints the screen four times, going from a coarse to an increasingly fine resolution. On my coprocessor LES286-based computer, the first screen takes about 9 seconds, the second 25 seconds, the third 1 minute and 25 seconds, and the fourth almost 6 minutes. However, you don't have to wait for the program to finish an image before you make a change to that image or start a new one. Chaos runs on IBM PC, XT, PC80, PS2 and compatible computers that have an EGA or VGA display and 640K of memory. Autodesk recommends a maths coprocessor, although one is not required. The software package includes illustrated 238-page manual, disks and quick reference program cards.
That review was by Julianne Schofield in Electronics Design News. And the software is priced at $59.95. And I thoroughly recommend the book by James Gleick that the software's based on, Chaos Making a New Science, in Viking Penguin in the States. It costs $14.95 paperback, and I think it's £8.95, or £7.95 in this country paperback. However, I found a copy for £5.50 in a place called Merton Abbey Mills in South London, in a bookshop, if you're interested in checking out a copy of Chaos Making a New Science. I think I'll have to read a bit of that book out in a week or so, because there's an interesting short snippet about how Mandelbrot came to discover his Mandelbrot set. So if we get some time in the next few weeks, I'll read out a bit of that book.
In England, the first person has been charged with owning an obscene computer disc. Here's part of the story on the Radio 4 Today programme. First, they played the noise a computer modem makes.
A sound like that becomes a hardcore pornographic image. John Dudley of Essex Computer Systems was sent some of the pornographic discs for his computer library. He handed them over to the police, but he says other libraries are keeping theirs.
There are still libraries that advertise adult and triple X material quite openly, which is part of the problem. I would say there's got to be 25% of software libraries that contain some kind of adult material. It's very widespread. It's very difficult to contain. Even the police obviously are having difficulty in keeping on top of it.
And the clarity of pictures now available on home computers is breathtaking. Steve James of the computer magazine CU Amiga points out a man doing sit-ups on this screen in his office.
Actually, what we're looking at now is a game which uses kind of like digitized images of a man boxing and doing sit-ups.
Very clear.
It's incredibly clear, actually. And that's the sort of quality, for want of a better term, that you get when watching a pornographic video on computer.
Quality is not the term the police are using. In Manchester, where particular attention has been paid to this very new problem, police say children are getting discs. One was caught passing them around a playground. The discs then join innocent-looking collections in children's bedrooms and can be coded with a password so parents have no chance of seeing what's in them. That greatly worries Chief Inspector Peter Butters, who runs Manchester Police's Obscene Publications Office.
We have evidence to suggest that children have already obtained discs and have been circulating them. The worrying aspect is, of course, that it only takes £20 to buy something like 20 discs, and it depicts some of the worst pornography I've ever seen in all my service. I have 25 years in the police service. I've never seen anything quite as depraved.
But it's not just that ordinary discs, like the one going into this machine, can be copied 40 times in an evening without any loss of quality. It's also, as Mr. James points out, that simple equipment can now allow a computer user to make his own pornographic film and put it on disc.
You need a device called a Genlock. One side would plug into a computer, the other end would plug into a video home recorder. Images can just be transferred straight from a standard home VCR onto computer floppy. It's that straightforward.
So straightforward that police in Manchester alone seized 1,200 pornographic computer discs last year.
Jeremy Vine on Radio 4's Today programme.
Well, a few years ago when I was at school, the heyday of the BBC Micro, much sniggering was caused by a programme which depicted an animated intimate act between a man and a pig. And most of the BBC Micro users I used to know would furtively take me or other people and show me this programme. And this satisfied me that us Spectrum users, which were arch rivals of the BBC Micro people at the time, it satisfied me that we were the sound people and all the BBC Micro users were a bunch of perverts. Anyway, you're listening to Sparks on Radio Fax 6205 3910 and 12255.
Digital shortwave radios from Roberts are now available through Radiofax sales. The RC818 at £205 is an attractive cassette portable with AM, FM stereo, shortwave, signal strength meter, BFO, stereo cassette, clock, a really useful timer, and sleep. There are 45 memories and keypad entry as well as a tuning knob. That's £205. The R808 at £125 is a medium-sized general coverage digital radio with 45 memories, keypad and tuning knob, signal strength meter, alarm and stereo on FM. For a small digital shortwave portable, there is the R801 at £85, which has 20 memories, clock, sleep and FM stereo. All prices include postage and VAT in the UK or airmail overseas. You can pay by cheque or credit card or ask for colour brochures from Radiofax Sales, The Forge, Cranley, GU6, 7BG, England. Telephone 0483 275 997. Roberts Quality Radios from Radiofax.
Anthony Mickle is writing from Mansfield in Nottingham. After many years of shortwave listening, I've been spurred to write to a radio station for the first time. I first heard your programmes while looking for the World Service, and for a while I thought I'd found it. Well, that's a compliment, I suppose. I listened to the Sparks programme that evening until you began to rebroadcast Caroline. Like another listener who wrote to you, I don't think that HF is a good medium for music, though admittedly from the point of view of a UK resident. I've listened to several editions of Sparks and am amazed to find every article interesting, particularly those concerning the audio industry. I like the magazine format and impressed by the variety of sources you quote from. Even the tape loop style suits me, as it's possible to listen with half an ear or with distractions and still catch all the information. Roll on the next 8-track cartridge. Well, it's not quite as old-fashioned and clapped out as that, but it's not far off. At home, I listened on a 50-year-old Collins TCS-12 transceiver set, and at work on a low electronics HF-150 using synchronous reception. I've only ever heard the 6205 signal, which is consistently solid, but never the other outlets. I work at the low receiver production unit in Derbyshire, where I align and test the three types of receiver we currently produce. I think we're the only manufacturer in this country producing a radio receiver for the Sirius shortwave listener. I could be wildly wrong, so give us a plug. Well, we will. It's a good value as well. I'm not surprised by the good reception on 6205 with 1 kilowatt, as it's my experience that good coverage of the UK and beyond is possible with a few tens of watts on 40 metres. You show 'em. I hope this letter isn't too long. Well, certainly not everyone's encouraged to write a long, interesting letter. And good luck from Anthony Mickel. And in a PS, he asks, why are we called Radiofax? Well, we started 4 years ago in April 88, and then all the programmes were like Sparks, in other words, technical news. But these days we don't have the resources to bring them to you every day, so you've got Sparks every week, Monday and Tuesday. Hello to Chris, who writes from Radio Geronimo, and thanks for the card and photos that you sent. Also a letter from Peter Schneider, who's in Würzburg in Germany. It's 3:30 in the morning. I just came home from my favourite bar, and I'm half drunk. Because I'm hungry, I'm sitting in my kitchen, and I switched on the radio on a frequency I listened to this morning. And what did I hear? Radiofax. Well, it's good to know we're getting the high-quality audience we deserve. Only joking, 6205 kilohertz is what he's listening on, and he says our signal is the best he's ever heard. His receiver's a Sony ICF 2001. I think your programme is very interesting and professionally made, especially if you compare it with the other stations. And thanks for the three stickers of the three local radio stations from your city, Peter. They are Carivari 97.1, Radio Gong on 90.4, and Radio West 1. 95.8, which is considerably more than you'd get in your average English town, isn't it? That's Peter Schneider writing from Würzburg in Germany. And according to Andrew Priest, Paisley is the place to be for pirate radio in Scotland. After a long period of nothing, there are now two FM stations in Paisley. Tonight I heard PWR, Paisley Weekend Radio, of course, on 100.5 in stereo. And over the past few weeks, another station has been on some evenings. Its signal is rather distorted, and its name something like Gnome FM or No FM on 101.7. The franchise for Paisley went to PLR, Paisley Local Radio, who were broadcasting last May on a special event license. Hopefully it will be more successful than Glasgow's East End Radio, which closed down last summer after a year on air. I thought EER was quite good, better than all the smarmy DJs on Radio Clyde. Keep up the good work with Sparks and the Archive Show, and also Jodie's Rock Show. I'm not a particular fan of heavy metal, but she's a good DJ and makes a change from Atlantic 252. Thanks, Andrew Priest. And he's got a PS. Radio 3 has finally left medium wave. It hasn't been there the last few days, and I don't think anyone will miss it. Not like the Radio 2 affair. Apart, that is, from when the cricket's on. I understand the cricket will take over Radio 3 FM all day, even in Scotland, where no one's interested in English cricket. Well, that's a thing that none of us down here had considered. Poor old Scottish classical music listeners having to listen to our wretched cricket all day. Well, thanks for that letter, Andrew.
The On the Ropes programme interviewed Bruce Gingell, boss of TVAM. In part of the interview here, he talks first of all about the big strike and then losing the franchise for the breakfast service.
And you ran it yourselves?
I ran it myself.
Shaky cameras, but it all worked.
Very shaky. And my gosh, I hadn't directed for 26 years or something like that, and I wasn't too good at that. And
I suspect you loved it.
Oh, I loved it. Marvellous time. I did my own camera work, cap gens, and switching. Now, I did the work of three people.
Partly as a result of that, perhaps, TVM ended up becoming the most successful, according to some people, financially successful television company in the world. Then you went on to lose the franchise. Now, why? Why didn't you say to yourself, this is a hugely successful company, I'm going to have to bid an awful lot to keep it? You were outbid by, what, £35 million to £14 million. Why did you bid so low?
I didn't bid low. You see, I think they'd bid ridiculously high. And I've said it before, I believe, I'd be very surprised if Sunrise is continuing financially, successfully by 1995. The fact of the matter is, we were successful, certainly the most profitable company in Britain, and the most profitable company in the world per hour of broadcasting. But one thing we did know was come 94, when Sky starts getting up to 4 million sets, that product advantage we had would be diminished. And whilst we were able to charge 100% loading for certain advertisements, that 100% was going to go. And I saw that there was at least a 30% potential drop in our income in the 94, 95, 96 onwards. So that the halcyon days leading up to 90 were never going to be again, in my view. And the interesting thing is, if you look at Sunrise's application, they believe in 95 there was £117 million of revenue. We believe there was £80 million for the revenue.
Right, but you talked earlier about having to cut your cloth accordingly. Shouldn't you have said, all right, they're going to bid a lot? You had the same sort of advice that they had, after all, and you knew that potentially there was going to be an enormous bid being put in by your competitors. Couldn't you have said, we'll bid that, we'll pay that, we'll keep the company, and then we'll trim our costs? So we've done it before, we can do it again.
I went through all that, but that was going to mean firing, in my view, 250 staff. And that wasn't going to be TVAM.
But you said you loved the company.
I do love the company, but I love the staff. I love the people there. I don't love an inanimate company. I love the people I'm with. And they were all going to have to be sacrificed. And my view was, we either maintained the company as it was, and that was our application, as it was, and keep the services we had, or we were going to be a different company.
Bruce Gyngell there, interviewed by John Humphreys on Radio 4. I've read many reviews of books in the arts pages of newspapers where the reviewer clearly took a very strong dislike to the book that he's reviewing. This one is no exception, but it is unusual in putting an entirely new slant on the activity of tuning your radio set. James Walcott reviews the book Vox, written by Nicholson Baker. Nicholson Baker writes as cute as a bug, which is both his appeal and his problem. His first novels, Room Temperature and The Mezzanine, established him as a master of nuggety detail, a Nabokovian nibbler. Like Nabokov, he seldom tells a story straight. He has a fondness for footnotes, afterthoughts, asides. His cardboard characters take a back seat to the strange artifacts he collects. For Baker, household products have an outer space charm. He showcases shoelaces, earplugs, telephones, and instant popcorn as if he had found them on Martian soil. Baker exhibits native delight when it comes to gumball colours and useless gadgets. He's proud to be a fuzzy American. Vox flaunts its slim intentions, offering cheap thrills in a classy console. The novel doesn't seem so much written as activated. Vox is at its best when it's pure appliance. Its erotic landscape is not the hills and lashing wind of romantic literature, but an electronic grid. Telecommunication has displaced nature. The silencers over the long-distance line have a cassette hiss. The lights on Abby's stereo bob like ocean boys. In Nicholson's most inspired conceit, Jim recalls how he imagined as a teenager that the radio dial was the city skyline at dark. The FM stations were the buildings, the AM stations their reflections in the water. He would pretend that the dot on the frequency band was a cab cruising the main drag. And sometimes I'd thumb the dial very slowly, sort of like I was palming a steering wheel, and move up, move up in the silence of the muted stretchers, and then suddenly I'd pierce the rind of a station, and there would be this crackling, hopped-up, luridly coloured version of a song that sounded for a second much better than I knew the song really was. Like that moment in solar eclipses, when the whole corona is visible, and then you slide down into the fertile valley of the station itself, and it spreads out beneath you in stereo, with a whole range of middle and misty distances. That's the most convincing orgasm in Vox, this solitary blip. It's a private frisson Jim elevates into a world view. Vox's smart success has created a backlash in America. The chief book critic of the Washington Post seized the occasion to climb a soapbox and lambast the literary world for pandering to cynicism, commercialism, and chic soulless depravity, not to mention serving stale peanuts at cocktail parties. Vox is too minor for such moralizing. The only shocking aspect of Vox is its triviality. It might have made a nifty short story. As a novel, it hangs around until it becomes a nuisance. Nicholson Baker's nerdiness can only be taken in small bites. James Walcott, clearly not that impressed by the book Vox, written by Nicholson Baker, published by Granta at £7.99 in paperback, making tuning a radio dial into an activity to be confined behind closed doors between consenting adults. And that was in The Observer.
Ooh-er. BT tunes in for widescreen TV broadcasts in Electronics Weekly by Richard Wilson and prepare the way for widescreen TV transmissions by 1995. BT's network will use the digital TV broadcast format being drawn up by the European Standards Body. Both PAL and future PAL Plus widescreen signals will be compressed into a 34 megabits per second data channel. BT is talking to Siemens and Philips about supplying the video codecs for the network. Although the network will use BT's main digital trunk network, the company expects to lay over 2,000 kilometres of new fibre to TV transmitters and sports venues like Brands Hatch and Wimbledon. BT's distribution network, which carries most of the UK's TV programmes from studios to transmitters, but it is facing greater competition for that business. National Trans Communications is the monopoly supplier of TV transmitter services up to 1996. BT announced last week that Channel 4 will start using the new digital network next January. The 10-year contract worth £50 million will enable Channel 4 to introduce a regional advertising scheme and offer 16:9 widescreen TV by 1995. This means we're possibly further ahead than anyone else in transmitting digital TV to people's homes, says Chris Daubeny, Channel 4's chief engineer. That report in Electronics Weekly. A letter now from Andy Cadier. I just had to send you the latest masterpiece from the Home Office via my local MP. Will he survive the election, I ask myself. You will observe the same old violin is being used in the same manner as it was before, to protect medium wave frequencies. This argument was not particularly convincing then, and is even less credible now, particularly with the USA continuing to license religious shortwave stations. The April issue of Shortwave Magazine's Pirate Page opens with a little about radio facts and a mention of the programme Sparks. I hope this helps just a little, perhaps, to get your station accepted in official circles. The suggestion of an ILR licence, or a bid for a national licence, shows clearly they don't understand the perception of radio facts, or if they do, they don't want to acknowledge it. That's from Andy Cadier, who is the writer of the Off the Record Pirates feature for Shortwave Magazine. Well, in a particularly bored moment, I maybe will read that letter out over the air. It's another one from the Home Office. I'll save it for another week, you'll be pleased to hear, however. And D.S. Barnwell writes from Brixham in Devon. He wants to have the information, which is on its way, and he says it's where all good fish come from, Brixham. And a good letter from D.S. Barnwell, thanks. In Italy, Salvatore Plac- Montinaccia. I think Montinotti is where he lives. He's listening on 6205 with a Grundig Satellite 500 with a telescopic aerial. Dear friends, I'm really astonished to get such fairly good reception from a transmitter of 1 kilowatt only. What I heard sounded like a DX program, but different from the same I usually hear from other radio stations. Letters from listeners with compliments to your station were mentioned. Well, thanks. Salvatore Planaccia. Another letter, including a small item. This is Ewan Cathcart in Aberdeen in Scotland. A short note to thank you for sending me information on your station, plus your station card. I enjoy all of your programmes very much, especially Sparks. I would like to contribute to your programme by sending you a newspaper cutting, taken from the Aberdeen Daily Newspaper, the Press and Journal. The article is on Britain's highest local radio station, Nevis Community Radio. The station was originally set up to provide a news and information service for the local ski centre, as well as providing a general entertainment service for the local population, with programmes mainly being provided by the ILR station Moray Firth Radio, based in Inverness, some 120 miles away. I hope you find the article interesting enough to include in your programme. Many thanks again for your excellent programmes, and I hope to contribute again sometime in the future. Well, thanks. Look forward to that, Ewan Cathcart. If you see anything interesting in your local newspaper, we'll be delighted to receive it. So, the hills are still alive with the sound of the radio. Britain's highest local radio station, broadcasting from almost 3,000 feet up a Lochaber mountain, has won a two-month reprieve. Now Nevis Community Radio, which was to have gone off the air next month, could be the first such station in the Highlands to get a permanent permit. It took to the airwaves for a pilot trial in January, broadcasting 10 hours a week. The station was to have shut down at midnight on April the 20th, but the response has been such that a two-month extension has been granted. This will enable the station to open again, probably in July, for an eight-week service for locals and visitors. Ms. Jackie McKenna, Development Officer for Lochaber Enterprise, said it was hoped to double output from 10 to 20 hours a week. Local response to Nevis Community Radio has been terrific, she says. There have been a lot of letters of support, and a lot of people are listening to the service. The station broadcasts around 10 hours a week by taking over the airwaves from the Inverness-based independent Moray Firth Radio. An aerial sighted on the restaurant high up the slopes of Anochel Moor picks up Moray Firth signals from Inverness, which are then relayed to a second mast at Banavy and beamed down towards Fort William. Well, thanks to Ewan for submitting that article. And if you'd like to write in with your comments or any submissions yourself to the programme, the address is Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG in England. And if you send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons or $1, then we'll send back our station card, also technical information sheets and an artist's impression of the transmitter site. So the address again, Sparks, Radio Fax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. Looking forward to receiving your letter.
I was standing in the station being pounded by the rain, so I chose the last compartment of a stationary train. I felt someone get in behind me, but I never caught their eye. But I thought I heard a woman's voice whispering goodbye. With the beer and coffee stains, and I stared out at the thunder through the broken window panes. And although the storm was booming like an engine in the sky, I'm sure I heard a woman's voice cry. I don't wanna be under your thumb forever. Don't wanna be under your thumb forever. Forever.
strange indeed. So I looked a little closer, and it chilled me to the bone. Woman throws herself from speeding train, identity unknown. But I recognized the picture of the woman who was dead. And underneath the picture, it said, don't wanna be under your thumb forever. Don't wanna be under your thumb forever. Don't wanna be under your thumb. It's over and done, I'll never be under your thumb.
This week on Sparks, the BBC make awful noises on FM, and I don't mean Radio 1. Fascinating facts about envelopes, a bit of chaos theory, obscene computer discs, flaky recording tapes, and how to preserve them longer coming up next. Two interviews, one with Bruce Gingell from TVAM and the other one from Liz Howell, who's the programme director from Sunrise TV, their successor in the morning.
Barry Fox in Studio Sound has been writing various pieces about degradation of early magnetic tapes. Here's another item. John McKnight of the Magnetic Reference Laboratory in Mountain View, California, echoes concern over the stability of tapes. As McKnight points out, the fact that urethane tapes react with moisture in the air and go sticky is neither new nor secret. It is just that the tape industry has done so little to publicise the fact that it might as well be new or secret. It is now nearly 10 years since Neil Bertram of Ampex and Edward Cudahy of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Pasadena, wrote about it in the IEEE Transactions on Magnetics. But what they wrote was heavy text, replete with mathematical formulae, tables and plots, all under the title Kinetics of the Humid Aging of Magnetic Recording Tape. The synopsis reads, kinetic data were generated for measurements of acetone extractable hydrolyzed binder products versus time for various humidity, temperature, environments, etc. All the warnings the industry needed were probably there, but in such obscure language that it is hard to imagine any working engineer getting past the first few sentences, even if they ever saw the article in the first place. Buried in the turgid text, however, is one bald statement. It is clear that further studies of chemical hydrolysis are necessary to understand completely the degradation process. Yes, the tape makers knew 10 years ago that they had a very real problem on their hands, and they did next to nothing to warn their customers. Later learned articles referred to heat treatment, but failed to come anywhere close to explaining in plain terms that baking a sticky tape makes it fit to copy. McKnight, who has been replacing reference tapes which have gone sticky, says he has been haranguing all the tape manufacturers for at least 5 years. At first, all they said was, gee, Mr. McKnight, we've never had anyone complain about that before. Then they admitted there was a problem, and they were working on it. Now they are talking about new formulations as yet unavailable. McKnight reckons that the tape makers are in a difficult position. They need urethane to cope with the strain of rotary head recording and repeated multi-track overdubbing. Urethane is tough, but it turned out to suck up water from the air and shed sticky goo. McKnight describes the urethane binder problem as a disaster. It seems inevitable that more and more people will now be taking tapes out of store and finding that they won't play. For those who find they are afflicted, the guiding principle is this. If a tape gums up your recorder, don't keep on trying to run it. Contact the tape maker about baking to dry it for long enough to make a safety copy. Brute force attempts at getting a tape to play may well end up stripping the oxide off the base and permanently ruining the recording. By coincidence, 3M has just publicised the successful reissue of material from 40-year-old tapes owned by Ace Records. The tapes were of early 1950s R&B artists such as Howling Wolf, Elmore James and B.B. King. Apart from some adhesive ooze from old splicing tape, says 3M, there were no problems. Although magnetic media technology has progressed considerably over the last 40 years, says Ted Carroll, director of Ace Records, these tapes provided us with usable recordings of more than acceptable quality. All the old Ace tapes were on acetate base. How many urethane tapes will be playable 40 years after they were made, or around 25 or 30 years from now? The awful thing is, no one knows. Barry Fox in Studio Sound.
And in Radio World, How to Preserve Recordings by Dee McVicker. Sound archivists at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill cooked up a scheme recently to save valuable recordings. Faced with rapidly deteriorating sound recordings of some of North Carolina's most distinguished folk musicians and storytellers, they baked 50 tapes for 4 hours at 122 degrees Fahrenheit. The oven technique was used on 1970s and 80s vintage reel-to-reel tapes, enabling the archivists to preserve one-of-a-kind recordings documenting historical vocalists and the rich African-American traditions of coastal and Piedmont North Carolina. Among the recordings preserved were those by popular singers Shirley Caesar and Elizabeth Cotton, field recordings of Southern folklore, in particular the rhymed stories passed on through generations of African Americans, were also preserved by the baking technique. We realized we had a body of important material, including some really fine performances, that was showing advanced forms of deterioration, said Mike Casey, sound and image librarian at the library's manuscripts department. We had to find some way of saving it for future generations. Funded by a grant, the university's manuscript department, which archives more than 40,000 recordings and some 10 million manuscripts, began seeking methods to restore the recordings long enough to re-record them onto long-term storage media. The archivists tried re-recording cuts onto various tape machines, finding some success with those that had fewer tape guides and parts in contact with the tape. That helped some, Casey said, but it was not a foolproof method, and we did not exactly have a whole run of machines to work with. After repeated attempts at these more conventional methods, the archivists decided to try the unorthodox approach of baking the tapes. The technique promised success by melting the tape's bindings slowly at a low temperature, so that when cooled, tape bindings would reformulate. We were aware that the technique was used by some tape manufacturers. I had heard talk of it at various conferences, Casey said. Gathering as much information as possible on the technique, the archivists constructed a small baking oven made out of cardboard. For the heating element, they purchased a hairdryer from a professional salon, with the largest number of settings as possible, because we did not know what we would need. Initial experiments were carried out on throwaway tapes in the same binding condition, which were donated by WUNC, the university's FM station. With these tapes, the group quickly discovered an effective temperature range. If you get into the 130 degrees Fahrenheit and above range, then there is the danger of melting the plastic tape. Lower temperatures will not do it, Casey said. In the final experiment, archivists spaced tapes in individual hubs to circulate heat uniformly on all sides. With the exception of two tapes that had to be re-cooked for an as yet unexplained reason, the baking technique proved to be effective for all 50 one-of-a-kind tapes. We were 100% effective, Casey said. He's not sure how long the technique can preserve tapes for replay, however. Experiments on the tapes donated by WUNC-FM show that transfer should occur within a month. Taking no chances, the group re-recorded the 50 tapes onto current generation mastering tape for long-term storage. That's written by Dee McVicker in the American publication Radio World. And another letter here from Dick Gustafsson, who's in Sweden. First of all, let me give you my compliments on the Radiofax operation. Even though it's considered a pirate, which isn't all that good over here, I know that Radiofax is a respected station among Swedish listeners. I'm 34 years old. When you first had Radiofax, I sent you a report, as you may record my name. Well, we do, yes. Anyway, I've been into radio since 1971, first as a DXer and later as a DJ. Since 1974, I've had a good friend as Bob Tomelski. He seems rather busy these days, though, so we don't have contact all that often now. Since 1987 or 88, I used to be regularly in contact with Paul Bentley and Chrissy. For almost 2 years, I used to do a weekly two-hour show on their WABC outlet in Donegal. Because of all this, I was very amused when they suddenly turned up on Radio Facts and Bob had a stint or two. Well, thanks, he says. All the best, and keep it going. Dick Gustavson. Thanks for that letter. And a letter from Sherborne in Dorset, from Nick Bentley. Whilst in search of a lower frequency on which to listen to BBC World Service, I came across your broadcast. I've got three shortwave sets, a Sharp FV310 and two Philips, a D2615 and a D1835. Well, thanks for that letter.
Woman's Hour programme, an interview with Liz Howell, who's the woman in charge of the programme company taking over from the breakfast company TVAM.
As in America, the audiences for early morning television are growing in this country. The biggest share at the moment switches on TVAM. As of January 1993, they'll be replaced by Sunrise TV, whose programme director is Liz Howell, but not Liz necessarily called Sunrise TV.
No, we will be changing the name.
Why?
Well, lots of reasons, really. There's a sunrise programme on Sky Television, and also I think a lot of us feel that sunrise is a little bit too Mediterranean and bright. If you're waking up in Newcastle or Glasgow, you know, you might think sunrise is a little inappropriate for a lot of the year.
Now, TVAM has had, obviously, a very successful formula. They have 70% of the audience at the moment. How is sunrise, or whatever it will be different?
Well, the first thing to establish is that we didn't win the franchise on any great grounds of quality because our programming was different, innovative, wildly exciting. We won the franchise because we bid more money. So there isn't necessarily an objective to change the programming. We will change it, of course, because we're all individuals with our own identity, but we do want to appeal to the people who at the moment watch TVAM. So we will take a lot of what's good about TVAM and build on that.
So what particularly?
What's good about TVAM, do you mean?
What do you want to take with you?
Well, I think that the informal, cheery atmosphere is terribly important. I don't think people necessarily want to be bludgeoned when they wake up in the morning. I personally find waking up and having to go to work is enough of a strain without feeling terribly worried and upset about the state of the world. So I think we have to be upbeat and we have to be cheerful. And that's something which TVAM does very, very well indeed. And I think the idea of a comfortable digest of programming is what we want to take from TVAM.
Does that mean you'll be keeping the same presenters?
No, we're not keeping the same presenters, but we are talking to some of the people who currently present on TVAM because they have a very good following.
There was a time 7 years ago when you actually gave up all this television stuff that you've been involved in and went to run a restaurant and post office in Cumbria. Why did you run away?
Why did I run away? Because I wasn't winning at the time, probably, to be perfectly blunt. And I wanted to have a baby, and I believed a lot of this stuff about going back to nature and all of that, and had a go at it. Although we did have a business, which was fairly successful, so I wasn't completely earth-mothering. But I wasn't very good at earth-mothering anyway.
So why did you come back?
Well, there were lots of practical reasons. It's very difficult to run a business, and Ian was in full-time work and was travelling long distances, and there was a baby and one thing and another. But basically, I missed it. You see, it wasn't my trade. My trade is being a broadcaster like yours, and I feel, it sounds a bit absurd, but I sometimes think I understand how sort of transsexual people feel, because I used to wake up in the morning and think I was in the wrong body. I was so much in the wrong job.
Now, you came back to Border, and then you went to Sky Television. What was the attraction of satellite?
Oh, it was just so different and so exciting, and it was non-establishment. And like everybody of my age in media, you try the battling up through the BBC board, and you try the ITV system and all those things. And Sky was completely different from all of that, and very exciting. I have to say that when I went there, I thought that CNN was the Canadian National Railways, so I had an awful lot to learn. But it was great, a fantastic experience.
So are you going to take any of your Sky presenters with you?
Aha, that's my secret, but they're very good, aren't they?
Television generally, I think, is experiencing tough times at the moment. What kind of future do you see for it as an industry?
Well, as an industry, I think it'll grow, obviously. I mean, all the indications are that more and more people are going to watch television, perhaps at more obscure times. But the great primetime thing of the whole nation sitting down to watch the army game or whatever, that's long gone. It's a different sort of media now. It is more fragmented. But I do hope that people don't think of it all as terribly competitive. You don't have to be a breakfast viewer as opposed to some other category of viewer. It's perfectly possible to watch breakfast sometimes and listen to the radio sometimes and listen to your CD player other times. And I think there's this obsession with, I'm not a breakfast viewer, or I am a breakfast viewer. It's very sad. I mean, there should be lots of choice for all of us.
Is it too soon to talk about a next step for you?
Oh, yes, it's far too soon. I think I'm a bit like a football manager, you know, a few home defeats and I could be out. So just keep your fingers crossed for me.
Liz Howell, thank you very much for being with us.
Parts of an interview there with Liz Howell by Jenny Murray on Woman's Hour.
The Philips DC777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM/FM tuner, and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard-size car radio unit. AM, FM, and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997 or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
A piece written under the nom de plume of Dipole in the IEE News. The strong brown manila envelope of years past is regrettably no longer commonplace. Typical low-priced large envelopes today are weak and floppy. Beware of entrusting a heavy A4 typescript to a modern envelope without special precautions. It will most likely arrive at the other end with severed edges. Yes, the edges are particularly vulnerable. Dipole believes that movement of the contents can add to the trouble, and the edges can, as it were, give way under impact. And some modern sorting requires letters and packets to be conveyed around curves, which is not friendly to thick items. Bend, more bend, split, oops. In that gentle battle of wits between the sender, who imagines his goods should arrive exactly as dispatched, and the carrier, who feels a sporting need to apply some modification, Scotch tape is a ready weapon. Tape along the edges can delay or prevent a burst, but good tape is expensive and the application is time-consuming. Before taping, fold in one or two edges to achieve a snug fit of the envelope around the contents. Two hazards are thus eliminated at once. If you are a truly neurotic taper, you will wish to cover all flaps and paper joins, and the shiny cocoon that goes to the post has barely enough exposed paper to accept stamps or the firm's franking strip. Padded bags, then. What about padded bags? The traditional softies are rag-stuffed and heavy, and accidental penetration of the outer skin releases a choking cloud of dust that tastes carcinogenic. Sadistic senders use industrial-strength staples, up to a dozen per bag, to seal the end flap, but there are clips and tags for the purpose if security in the sense of secrecy is not a problem. Modern, lighter bags with bubble plastic linings look attractive, but the bubble stuff restricts the space inside. Some bags, both old and new types, have the disadvantage that hardly anything will stick to their matte surfaces. Labels lift, transparent tape curls up and falls off, and even wide brown parcel tape, the panacea of industrial packaging, finds no purchase. Despair? No. Dipole has discovered envelopes that survive because they are virtually untearable. They are white, shockingly expensive, and appear to be quite flimsy. But their paper behaves like a tough fabric in the face of attack. One manufacturer, at least to Dipole's knowledge, has all the market share, which no doubt accounts for the high price. But Dipole is impressed enough to buy and use them. The self-adhesive flap seems weak, so back to the tape again, but only here. The tape sticks, so do labels. There is a downside in that ballpoints will not mark them. Nylon tips do, but above all, with conventional treatment en route, they do survive. Success is dearly won. Hints and tips about envelopes there by Dipole in IEE News.
Well, that material I've personally seen because I've had a few of them sent to me. And it's, I can't remember the name of the stuff, but it's the same stuff that 5 1/4 inch disc envelopes are made out of. It's sort of plastic that you just cannot tear. Wonderful stuff. However, I don't think we'll be purchasing any of those envelopes quite yet. I'll stick to the sellotape myself. Although you can certainly reuse the ones that people send you many, many times, as I do on my ordinary envelopes. A letter from Marcel Tonilodo dos Anjos, who's in Osasco in Brazil. He's 26 years old and a chemical engineer. And here's his letter. I'm happy because for the first time I tuned to your radio station. My friends Carlos and Felipe tuned your broadcasts and wrote to you last year, but I was unable to listen to your programs. Now I've tuned you and I'm waiting for you to say it. He's listening on 12255 with a Yaesu FRG7700. He's got an inverted L Marconi aerial. What he says in his reception report checks out. And thanks for the postcard of Sao Paulo. That's Marcelo Toniolo dos Anjos. Thanks for the letter. More letters. Here's Ashburton, Newton Abbott, the place in South Devon. And it's Simon Wood. I was searching across the broadcast bands when I found Radiofax. I then looked in the pirate radio station's page in January's shortwave magazine and found that you were in there, but for two frequencies given, 6205 and 12255, which was surprising as this frequency I'm listening on is 3910. Well, of course, that's the newest addition to our frequency ranges. At this present time, I'm listening to a documentary show about the new radio franchise, which will use Radio 3's medium wave frequency. He's listening on a Philips D2935 shortwave. He's also got an AOR950 scanner for VHF and UHF. He uses a 23-metre long wire aerial. He's in a small town known as Ashburton, near the city of Exeter. Yes, I've visited it a few times. I've had a long interest in radio since I was about 10 years old. I'm now 17 and hoping soon to invest in a better, more stable HF receiver, possibly a low HF225. I also like to listen to single sideband transmissions, especially amateur, on 80-metre and 40-metre bands. So far I've logged about 800 stations since August on and off. I don't get a lot of time as I work quite long hours. Most of my listening is done between 7 and 10 o'clock in the evenings, and most of the day on Sunday. I have a QSL card collection with 40 from amateurs and one from the Manx Radio in the Isle of Man. That's Simon Wood's letter, and he's asking if we could name a good book with frequencies for the broadcast stations. Well, of course, the World Radio TV Handbook, published by Billboard in the United States, is quite a lot of money, £20, though for a lot of people it's making itself a bit of a joke by not listing stations which are always on the air, like the Irish medium wave and FM stations, and on shortwave Radio Dublin and ourselves. There's up-to-date listings from the British DX Club, and you can also buy the World Radio TV Handbook through them. In this country, there's the Radio Listener's Guide for broadcast stations, but that's medium wave and FM only.
In the Financial Times, BBC review may cut 10,000 jobs by Raymond Snoddy. The BBC should review the potential for contracting out all its activities, which could cost up to 10,000 jobs over the next 5 years, according to an internal working party. The radical recommendations are contained in a confidential report by one of the 15 task forces set up to look at every aspect of the BBC's role in advance of the renegotiation of its Royal Charter, which runs out in 1996. Recommendations from all the task forces are being collated and will be considered by the BBC Board of Management and Governors in May. The task force on BBC services argues that all BBC activities should be reviewed this year to see whether they are suitable for contracting out. Some BBC departments could even be privatised by sale or management buyout. The committee, chaired by Mr. Bob Pugh, General Manager of Administrative Services at London Television Centre, says implementation should start by early next year. The document, leaked to the BEC2 Broadcasting Union, says rapid implementation would help show politicians, civil servants and the public that the corporation has a genuine commitment to becoming leaner and more efficient. At the beginning of last year, there were about 23,500 staff in the home services of the BBC, 25,000 including BBC Enterprises and Open University production staff. The savings mentioned in the report would come from buying in services and from Producer Choice, the BBC initiative allowing producers to buy services on the open market. Mr. Michael Checkland, BBC Director General, has repeatedly emphasised that the corporation would remain a significant programme producer. Mr. Roger Bolton, the BEC2 official responsible for BBC members, said, "What you are looking at is the disintegration of the BBC as a programme maker." Last month, Mr. Robin Corbett, Labour's broadcasting spokesman, wrote to Mr. Checkland warning that the nature of the corporation was being changed irreversibly in advance of a public debate getting underway. Raymond Snoddy in the Financial Times. One of the groups to most consistently get their act together on a Sunday morning is WNKR. Recently, they've also been operating on 3945. So, if you are listening to our 3910 signal late on a Saturday night, why don't you tune off the side like this?
I think that's quite enough, actually. He's not very good. It was an old song originally done by Doris Troy called I'll Do Anything, but it wasn't Doris Troy or anything, in fact, to do with it. Hot chocolate. This is 1978 as well.
The mystery singer was, yes.
Every Everyone's a winner right here. Radio Fax Solid Gold Sunday.
And tune up to 3945.
If you want to write to us with any reception reports or any requests or dedications for us to play on our normal Sunday morning broadcast on 6400, then all you've got to do is write to that address. Hey, right, bit of oxygen here. Might need a bit of oxygen. This is Sean Michel Jarre and Oxygen 4. You're in tune to WNKR 3945 on a Sunday morning. Very early on a Sunday morning, it happens. Very, very early.
So that starts at midnight on Saturday on 3945, a sensible signal there from WNKR in the 75-metre broadcast band, which is generally so underused that even the DTI would have difficulty describing it as congested.